Hey friends, it's been a while since episode 3 came out. I've actually recorded a few episodes for you, but every time I do it, I end up thinking, this doesn't feel quite right. I had an episode on leadership development, the terrible state of leadership development, and at least in Australia and enterprise land, more akin to domesticated adult daycare than anything else. And I had one on multipolar traps, particularly why rogues need to keep their wits about them and detect multipolar traps, and even if we can't escape them, to at least keep ourselves from becoming completely ensnared by them, which linked to a lot of platform and shitification, network effects, power laws, etc. I didn't publish that one either. In both of these instances, I've been, how do I say this? I've realized that I'm in a chapter in life at the moment where the intellectual headiness, the cleverness, the way with words doesn't impress me so much anymore. There's more of an embodiment that I'm alive to, where I'm actually listening to and sensing into intuition more than ever before, which I'd previously scoffed at as some sort of pre-rational superstition. But now I'm, bolstering my intellect with more than just the heady rationalism. And so, yes, I'm trying to pay attention to that. So rather than publish something that lives on the internet forever that I'm not necessarily comfortable with, I haven't published it. But at the same time, I've noticed that anytime I record something I'm not necessarily comfortable with, it, I think there's something not quite natural about the fact that we can record ourselves and it lives forever on the internet. And this is something that we talk about in this episode. In this episode, I finally have something I'm actually happy to share. And it's because I was in conversation with a wonderful person, Simon van der Els, a Netherlands-based molecular biology PhD turned shaman. And there is something profound, I find, about finding a kindred spirit. We're around a similar age. We have similar stories around our quickening into the more than rational realms, similar time period of imbibing the metacrisis and having the insight cascade that realizes, you know, that has us properly realize that we are on track for self-termination and that collapse is not only imminent, it's already happening. And that the underlying generator functions of the metacrisis, which produced the climate crisis, the food crisis, the energy crisis, the polarization in society, the growing wealth inequality, all of these things, the pathway to resolving it is non-obvious. But one of the things that is common amidst it all is healing, is actually doing the development work and healing our wounds and rising to adulthood, which not many of us do in Western society, at least. And so Simon I met on LinkedIn, of all places, the sterile corporate platform that is LinkedIn. And I just love how he shows up. He shows up, there's a kind of warm authenticity. There's no posturing. There's no pandering. There's no pretentiousness or facade, or at least if there is, it's in a way that seems so warm and authentic. And so, yeah, we've been kind of doing the dance, seeing how we kind of appear on each other's feeds, I guess it were. I've also watched and listened to Simon in conversation with other minds that I greatly admire. And I love the way that he shows up, not to be the cleverest guy with the fanciest words and so on, but there's a real warmth and presence and a genuine attention that is provided and given. And I really like that. We had a brief conversation before this recorded conversation, but this is effectively our first time chatting together. And one of the things I really love about this is he's also a complexity practitioner and quite comfortable with emergence. And it's nice to chat with someone who also doesn't want to crowd out and collapse the possibility space with by preordaining, here's what we're going to be talking about and we'll do this and here's the structure of it all, but instead to have the container and just allow what emerges to emerge. And we did have one guiding beacon, and that is a shaman and a wizard walk into a bar. And that was enough of a thematic anchor that beautiful things emerged. And so in this conversation, we actually venture into some realms that could be considered meta-rational, post-rational, para-rational, in any effect, beyond the kind of, beyond the normative, consensus, conventional way of seeing the world. And so I just ask of you, as you're listening to this, just be wary of your own allergies, the exaggerated reactions that we have to particular words and phrases. We're going to be talking about magic. We're talking about wizardry. We're talking about demons. We're talking about a lot of things that that might make you think, hang on, what's going on here? Has Jason lost his mind? Not at all. It's just that I'm more than ever open to exploring phenomena that maybe we don't have, at least in late-stage capitalist distraction economy, Western civilization, we might not have the language for, but there's something amidst it all that's worth exploring. So yeah, this is a conversation with that. There's also another quality I find really refreshing. So way back when I did my first podcast, I was interviewing other thought leaders, and naturally there's a thing, you know, you're a thought leader, you want to show up, you want to seem like the expert authority with the kind of fluency and the charisma and the ready answers to the common challenges. And you've got your shtick, you know, the lines that you use, they're charismatic, and they've got what's that word? The alliteration, the enunciation, the kind of the poetics of it all. You know, it's just down pat. But my experience is, I'm less interested in the polished presentation stuff these days. Maybe it's just exposure effect. Like, I've seen too much of it. I know what happens behind the scenes, and this is glamoury work, right? It's kind of magic itself. What fascinates me, though, is when you can have people that genuinely show up as their whole authentic selves with a kind of presence and a willingness to venture into domains that could be considered a space of mutual bafflement. And this is where I think our true work lies, to paraphrase Wendell Berry's beautiful poem. The mind that is not baffled is unemployed. It is the impeded stream that sings. And to actually dance at the edge of knowledge and amidst the space of unknowing and emergence and the tension, without kind of, whilst maintaining what poet John Keats would describe as negative capability, the ability to kind of be in suspension, to be amidst paradox, to avoid irritably grasping at certainties or collapsing the possibility space into known things, but instead to kind of be amidst the generative paradox and the generative ambiguity and to see what emerges. I mean, there's something so special and sublime about that. And I got to experience that with Simon, as you'll soon hear. Another thing I should probably say is that in this podcast, I haven't done the hours of tedious work that I've done with the other three podcasts, where I've gone through and meticulously edited the transcript. I'm, you know, whilst the world has peak inflated expectations about artificial intelligence, because this has been something that's been on my radar for many years, I feel like I'm in a, not so much disillusionment, but I'm just not that impressed. And artificial intelligence attempt to transcribe what this wizard says, with his perhaps talking a little bit too fast most of the time, it doesn't impress me. In fact, it's wildly inaccurate. And so I'd often have to spend hours and hours meticulously editing my own words, which means I have to confront myself after recording these things, which means I'm more likely to not want to publish it. So this time, I'm not doing the captions. AI can handle the transcript. I just have to apologize. If there's anything that I've said that isn't clear, or if there's any phrase or a word that I've used, please get in touch wherever this is published, and I can help to clarify the situation. Probably the YouTube comments is the best thing, I guess. Certainly not email. I'm not very good at email. But let's just see how this goes. I'm trying to depressurize this project. This whole thing was meant to save me time so I could spend more time writing the book. But instead, as is the irony of such things, it's taken more time than I would have otherwise expected. So, yes. A lazy publish of this episode. It's my first episode in conversation with someone. I really, really love this conversation personally. The overlaps in what Bill Plotkin talks about with soul work is really live for me at the moment. And if you're the type of person that's curious, that is willing to, appreciate an ironically sincere or a sincerely ironic metamodern-ish, regenerative, transrational, liminal, emergent take on magic, I think you'll enjoy this episode. So thank you so much for joining me. Simon van der Els is a little bit mysterious and hard to find online, but if you look him up on LinkedIn, you will find him, and Simon himself offers wonderful programs for folks that are also experiencing or wanting to engage in depth work and the development work of adulting. Anyway, let's get into the episode proper. Thank you so much for joining me. It's a delight. I'm going on a slight break over the summer to mostly focus on book writing, but I have some exciting things coming up for you in the new year, including some new online programs, which are going to be cohort-based, where we get to have more quality time together. So anyway, thank you for joining, and enjoy this episode of A Shaman and a Wizard Walk into a Bar. So how are you? How's your context?
Well, I was thinking, like, okay, is this going to be another night where I hardly sleep? And is that tied to us having conversation? But that wasn't the case, so that was good.
What's the time for you at the moment?
It's now 9 in the morning.
Oh, gooder. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, so it's not 7 o'clock or something. Mm. But, pretty good. I've had quite a heavy processes over the last week and a half. And I've been mostly, trying to deal with that. And at the same time, also just, live.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it's been quite intense and trying to stay calm and not wanting to overfit and make sense of things. And at the same time, just allow things to happen. So.
Yeah, that's great. When you say quite intense processes, is this part of the work that you're doing with folks?
No, I think it's mostly this is my own patterns that seem to be.
I see.
Some things seem to be unraveling. So I spent Sunday morning, 3 hours in the morning just purging. So I had a lot of like. I needed to vomit, and no physical ailments at all. It's just all energetic weird things. And this is without ayahuasca or anything. So
yeah, that's right. Yes. I saw a meme that that vomiting is like one of the few last things in which we have an experience of at-one-ment. Where you lose sense of time and all concern, you're just so present in the process, and that's pretty special.
Oh yeah, that immediately flashes back to me a journey I did with one of my dearest friends, and during we had such a big laugh because we talked about what it means to be able to vomit. Voluntarily, so under command, to hold that power, and we were both in awe of what that would mean.
I know that we were titling this A Wizard and a Shaman Walk into a Bar, and already that is a weird flex, but okay. The shaman says, I can vomit on Dante.
Yeah, I haven't figured it out yet. So, we were both just very.
That's right.
Musing on the idea of how
2025 goals. Yeah. No, there's jokes aside, there's something to be said about developing that acuity in relationship with the parts of the embodied experience that for most of us remain automatic or subconscious or not something that we can intentionally enact.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That has been one of my practices is to... So I'm by no means super experienced, but I had a Vipassana experience 2 years back, which was sort of really welcoming for the sort of my process and the deepening. And I wasn't into energetic healing, shamanism, anything at all at the time. But I've been playing around with that technique in my own processing. And then it really comes down to being able to lie completely still, and where Vipassana journeys through the body. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's a meditation
technique. I haven't done it myself, but I have many friends that have. Yeah. When I say and many it, friends, a few friends. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's it's sort of traveling with the attention through the body and allowing things to unfold as they want. But Vipassana is very much a continuous movement throughout the body. So you're not attaching to anything. And in my practice, or what seems to be working very well for me, is lying completely still and then sort of almost laser focusing on the spots that bother, and then not trying to alleviate the stress, but just to sit with the stress. And sometimes the stress massively increases. But just to sit with that until it starts to open and unfold, and then it will transfer to another part of the body. And for me, how I think it's working is normally when we have pain, our attention goes on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. And then we go like, oh, I want to move differently. So if the pain is an X amount of attention that it's drawing, that's how I try to look at it. It's like, okay, what happens if you give it the full attention it wants? And then maybe it's very intense for a brief moment, but then later it will drop off and then probably present like, okay, this is why I'm calling your attention. So it's talking to the body.
I had an intense migraine once whilst I was at an airport, and there was a friend there that was able to... I had experience of migraines before, and he downloaded a guided meditation specifically for migraines. And I haven't never thought to do this myself intentionally, as you have, but the meditation itself, I didn't have the energy to do my normal kind of scoffing or what is this going to be, some mindfulness, just breathe or thing. But the meditation itself was specifically an inquiry as to where the migraine is located and where to find the source of it, and the experience of actually giving the pain attention and finding it had this, just as you say, like you'd find it, you'd almost grasp it, but it would dissolve, and then it might appear in other things. And in the process of just giving it a kind of loving attention, it eventually dissipated, which was quite profound and unexpected. It's interesting, and that was years ago. And I think perhaps because it was a guided meditation, I kind of just surrendered and didn't really think much of it. But what fascinates me about what you're sharing, and what I'm just going to share a few things. I watched a snippet of you in conversation. I'm not sure who it was. I just skipped to the middle, but you're describing some of your practice. And then I was chatting with a friend based in Germany who has done work with you. And it was just coincidentally, because we're talking about Bill Plotkin. And then I said, oh, do you happen to know Simon? And then voila, you've done work together. So it's an uncanny sequence of beautiful coincidences. But the thing that I find fascinating, as one fellow, post-PhD, survivor to another, how you've found yourself with the patience or with the sensibilities to really, how do I say this? The practice of unfurling and developing this space does not, it's not you can't track progress in a linear or a quantified sense. It's a felt sensibilities, experience, and intuitive. I don't even know that question to ask. I guess what I want to communicate is I'm fascinated by the quiet rigor in which you go about the process of learning and leaning into all of this, particularly in this age where we don't have elders and, we do, but we don't necessarily have the structures in place for someone to develop and grow maybe I'm projecting here, but my sense is it's not necessarily straightforward, and yet somehow you are persisting amidst.
Yeah, thank you. That's it's also interesting to receive that and to feel a bit, because from first person perspective, the process isn't that rigorous. Does it often feel that rigorous? And it often feels very chaotic and...
That's heartening to know.
Yeah.
That is really heartening to know, because sometimes when I've tried to myself to genuinely lean into the kind of mythopoetic unfurling, the soul work, the Gurdjieffian whim fulfillment, all of the other things, it's a flip of the coin. Half the time I feel like, am I just being a bit of an idiot here? This feels like, am I wasting my time or whatnot? And then sometimes it feels utterly profound. And then I notice it feeling profound, and then I start thinking about it, and somehow the experience collapses, and there's this weird dance of it all, you know?
Perfect. I want to tie in something, because I was thinking yesterday, I was thinking about, okay, we're going to have a conversation. Often we'll see it's emergent, so we'll just step in. But I had a thread where I thought, like, this is interesting to put to bring in, and it ties directly to what you just said. I've been reading Roadside Picnic by the Strugatsky brothers. I think they're brothers. Are you familiar with the novel? Okay,
no.
I haven't read it before, so I'm very. I'm not surprised, because it's a sort of science fiction classic. The movie Stalker is based on this short book. It's about 190 pages. For the listeners, I would say look it up or read it. It's interesting. At the beginning of the book, so the whole idea of the book is aliens have had a roadside picnic on Earth. And then left. So they came and they left various zones on Earth. They're now called zones, and it's very reminiscent of, for instance, Chernobyl, like this eeriness of a region that is contaminated in a way, but humans don't understand it at all. And the book is it's written from the perspective of a stalker, which is a person who goes into the zone to reclaim alien artifacts. But the idea is that these artifacts are like the plastic waste of the picnic of the aliens. So the humans have no clue what these artifacts are and do, but all the rules of reality have shifted. So gravity is weird in spaces and other places. You don't walk past this doorway or this pavement or you'll be incinerated. So it's completely strange. Is very well written, but the stalker has to bring an academic into the zone because he wants to retrieve a certain object, and the academic is shitting himself as they go in. So he's talking a lot, and it's super anxiety inducing. And the stalker points him towards one of these strange manifestations of this alien contraptions. And he's constantly observing what the rules are, because the rules constantly shift in the zone, or you have to sort of follow rigorous observation and patterns. And he's pointed towards this sort of gravity anomaly kind of thing, whatever. And then the scientist who is researching these things calls it a name. So he says, oh, it's the Gravitron blah, blah, blah. And then he the stalker notices that the scientist loses his anxiety. And it's written like that. And I was like, ah, this is great. This is a great example. Like, okay, we name something. We collapse it into a box. And then we say, ah, now I know. Now I understand what it is. Mm. Even though it's super clear, nobody has any clue what the thing actually is.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. I definitely have thoughts about naming. quick side note, is this also a video game? Because I think I might have seen some... Yeah. I have a friend that's playing Stalker 2, and he was over dinner just describing this world, and it sounded fascinating, as well as the story of the development team that made it. And it's quite... I find that just like books, video games have become such a powerful medium for smuggling in, well, profound sensibilities, lore. I feel like there's a lot of syncretism. There's a lot of knowledge, a lot of I don't know the right word to say, but there's a lot that is hidden in plain sight and amidst the symbols that are used that just keep on recurring. So that's fascinating. But I think that as I would suggest that both you and I in different forms are complexity practitioners in the sense that we work in complex and emergent domains and we don't want to contaminate the possibility space by preempting what will happen. Hence why, you know, even in this call, we're both appropriately treating it tending to the generative ambiguity and kind of not forcing it into a particular direction. But also as complexity practitioners, we beware the kind of the dangers of premature collapse or when we collapse a possibility space. And, you know, I think about in this appears a lot in various fantasy novels, and Ursula Le Guin talks about true names and naming and how names have power as a recurring motif. And then it's also something that Tyson Yunkaporta warns of with regards to sharing indigenous knowledge systems, in that you want to really beware the dangers of naming something, because then it opens up the pathway to commodification, to corporates running with something and kind of having a dangerously limited sense of the richer complexity of the interrelationality of things because something is named. And so there's an intentional kind of mixing up or like you've got to preserve some trickster spirit to kind of keep the animacy of the whole interrelations alive. So going back to your example within the story here, I can see how the naming for a naive mind might have kind of given a false sense of like certainty and power and control, which is a classic patriarchal move in a complex system that happens all the time. Like within all living systems, I feel that would be a false sense of certainty and clarity. And so,
it's really the image that comes for me with naming is the. Naming allows indeed for abstraction and decontextualization. So you put a box around something so you can manipulate it. So you're taking it out, and then comes in the error, potential error of mistaking the map for the territory. So the fence you put around, and if something is really wild and moving, it won't be fenced in that well. And so whatever beautiful spot you found and you put a claim on it, you put a fence, picket fence around it, and are like, yes, I found the method. Maybe the season shifts and all the animals just disappear, which made it magical. And at a certain moment, the wellspring dries up, and then you have a fenced piece of desert. And often it can feel for me, I've been using that metaphor somewhat with so you have rewilding practices in
the physical. That's where I was going to get. Yeah, exactly.
And For me, it can often feel like we, I say we, but let me just speak from the I perspective, and I'm implying the we as a sort of collective, the Western thought, or being a sort of a modern subject, is that we are in a sort of, I am in a sort of hermetically sealed box of modernity that constantly is decontextualizing reality and tries to build more fences around things. So whenever something wild enters, there's so many parts of me that will go, how do I domesticate this thing? This is a great insight. Let's capture it in words and then reproduce it so I can, I can give it to others. And it's been recovering academic for me feels very much like that part of me has to recover, because that part is overloaded and insane. There's so much generational and multi-generational weight behind that way of being. Mm. And it's just projected through me into the world.
Yeah, which is, you know, for both of us, I'm sure is tied up to the unraveling of the adolescent self, you know, the kind of the form that of various maladaptive coping practices that help to shape an identity, a unique social identity. But, you know, because I look back to my past self of 10 years ago, even 6 years ago, maybe, king of mitwits, you know, king amongst the mitwits. I was, you know, I was so clever and smart and naming all the things. Had all these quick facts and you know, ready knowledge and insight into things. And now I'm not so sure. We have my partner and I, Kim and I, have a couple of academic friends, both professors, that are very much into birding. And they've introduced us to the wonders of birding, and they have a beautiful way of going about it, which is largely just to be amidst and appreciate the gestalt and to delight in wonder of the various birds that are sighted. And they were sharing about how there is a tendency sometimes for, you know, folks to maybe see a bird and then kind of quickly go into the app to kind of log that they've seen the bird and so on. And the kind of witnessing turns into a abstracted, commodified, quantifiable game, which then makes me think of James Carse's distinction between finite games and infinite games, where finite players play within boundaries, infinite players play with boundaries. And we come back to this domestic, you know, the domestication, the modernity, similar to what Tyson Youngerporter says, that the war between good and evil's more a case of artificial simplicity and stupidity overlaid onto complexity and wisdom. And, you know.
Nice. I like that.
That's the softening. That's the dissolving that we kind of need to persist within.
Mm. When you talk about birding, when I was a child, I often went bird watching. I was fascinated with birds of prey. And ooh, I used to go out on holidays. We were on an island north of the Netherlands, Terschelling, which is also, I think, a sort of protected wildlife area for a lot of migratory birds. But they had a lot of birds of prey. So I used to go out in the morning by myself for an hour or two when I was really little, just to go, well, stalk birds, just watch them. And I made it a game to get as close as possible without being spotted. And that was a very, yeah, that's a very, if I feel into that, that's a super lovely childhood memory. Mm-hmm. And I have to think back recently, I had a psychedelic journey in the local woods in a sort of ritualistic or more ceremonial setting. And it became so profound hearing the birds song and feeling that as you say, like part of a gestalt, part of the whole forest. And then it became more and more apparent to me in that state. I cannot fully re-embody it currently, but that the birds are channeling parts of the energy of the woods. So it's less a bird is a producer of this song, and it's more a bird settles on certain places in the trees, in the woods, and is expressing the energy that is there. So that's why, that was the feeling I was getting and this perception. And as the wind is blowing through the woods, the whole forest becomes this living entity. And you have different expressions of that entity. So it was very beautiful to also be part of that with my own expressions. I wasn't singing, but more so shaking at these kind of things, but listening.
That sounds profound. There's part of me that envies what I'm imagining of this forest here, because the landscape in Australia is it can be quite it's quite you need to be a pretty advanced level character, because the spiders, the ants, the wasps, the snakes, the crackliness of the kind of the prickles and things like there's a lot going on. So I'm not that there yet to be able to surrender on a journey in the midst of the wilderness, but I'm certainly hoping to find a patch. I grew up near the ocean, so somewhere in the sand dunes with the night sky, with the stars and stuff like that, I think that would be pretty magic if I can, but I'm relatively new to this whole, how do I say this? I've been in my head for so long. It took a descent into a kind of prolonged low grade depression. I don't know why I have to qualify the depression, but like a darker chapter that led me to ultimately have a plant medicine retreat with an incredible shaman who has, the metacrisis aware and all of the things, and I was able to kind of hold space and say, and it was just the most profound healing and the best thing I've done since. And that was only earlier this year. But since then, suddenly I'm realizing how much wisdom the body has within it, and how the wider wisdom and intelligences that I'd been otherwise, that were otherwise occluded to me as I was so stuck in my head.
So this stuck in your wizarding ways.
And that's an interesting thing. I kind of want to make a confession here for this wizard and shaman in a bar talk. For most of my life, I've had a deep affinity for foxes. I don't know why. Might have something to do with my last name. But I've really admired the trickster spirit and how they show up. And whenever I proclaimed wizardry, which originally was just a means for me to distinguish against thought leaders, because that was the game that I was playing, I always thought I'm actually like a rogue or a trickster playing the role of wizard, because wizard, that role works in this context. And there's this shape-shifting element that was at play. But to quote from Patrick Rothfuss of The Name of the Wind, Bast, one of the Fae, was saying, we understand how dangerous a mask can be. We all become what we pretend to be. And there's this kind of becomingness that you play a particular role for enough time, it becomes a part of you. And so, and it's also the classic thing of the more you know you don't know. And so here I am feeling like just a beginner at all of this, recognizing that there are profound ancient lineages of wisdoms and teachings. And I think the thing that's interesting is not so much like there's a commonality, even though there's distinct roles between wizards, shamans, witches, sorcerers, druids, tricksters, enchanters, omniromancers, all the things, right? There's distinct roles, but the commonality is an acuity for Maybe an acuity and reverence for magic and emergence and resonance and relationality and I don't know quite how to describe it. And I'm intentionally creating the word cloud, so we're not kind of collapsing it all into. I'm happy for you to kind of pick up the thread here, because yeah. I'm like, but there's something.
As you were speaking, the image that came to me was because I've also been in. I think we are in a similar trajectory, experienced a similar trajectory. For me, it's also been I've only stepped on this path when I was finishing my PhD and got into existential depression and go to the deep depths.
Yeah.
There's this part of us that wants to map. So let's say the part that wants to domesticate. And if we are so clever and enamored by our mental cognition, we are very, very good at mapping the land. So we're continuously building new walls, new fences, so we're colonizing, this whole space. And as we're colonizing it, it feels like, we know how this works. And we create paved roads going from one place to the other. You're creating this wonderful empire within your head, in your being, until you overstretch. Or until you start wandering all the parts of the empire that you think you know, and you're actually walking on the ground instead of looking at it from an aerial perspective or I'm watching my kingdom. And you're figuring out like, oh shit, it's not at all how I know. Or the infrastructure is crumbling, actually. And then trying to patch things up and then it will collapse. So it's like a civilizational collapse that happens within. But the ability to map great pieces of land will then becomes humbled. And after being humbled, then the map maker, or like the emissary, becomes the emissary of the master, like Ian Gilchrist talks about. And then the left hemisphere becomes comes in service of the right hemisphere. And I think that's when the fun comes in, because then you're capable of mapping and abstracting quite well or fast, but you know when to do it and when not. And then it's still a balance. I'm still learning. And because more often than not, when I get frustrated or in my own process, it doesn't happen too much with our work with other people, because for some reason I have way more humility and calm when I work with others than with myself. So that's also something to be aware of. But to be able to continuously breathe, let's say, keep it open, map, let go of the map. Open, map, let go of the map. Because we do need to map in between. Because if you're just, maybe you've had those kind of experiences. If you have very intense dreams or psychedelic experiences that let's say, go beyond what your brain can comprehend, then it's like you're just an open channel and information goes through, but you have no means of embodying it or gathering it or just making sense of it. And then you're just left like, okay, what just happened?
Yeah. I sometimes wonder whether the context that we're in, there's an extra challenge I find in that, say we're map making after experiencing the appropriate sequence of entropy and ontological collapse, and we've had to kind of then be amongst the existential funk and despair and abyss and then underworld and kind of reassemble some sort of somewhat metastable self-concept. If it was just oral tradition, say if these stories kind of lived on and they're telling and they're retelling, I think we might be okay. But because we have the internet that preserves a snapshot of, you know, it kind of there's this almost undeathly eldritch kind of stasis that certain thinking is preserved in. And then that exists in a domain where even where I was looking at a video of you from only 2 weeks ago, but still that's kind of you in a different context in a different time that then is present to me right now. And there's this temporal muddling or I don't know. I often feel haunted by my past self that lives on the internet. And
yes. You're familiar with, this is a lovely thread of thinking. You're familiar with, well, I take it you're familiar with tabletop RPGs, role-playing games, these kind of things, yes. Simulacra, like high-level wizards creating sort of versions from of themselves that they can then employ to do the things that they don't want to do, but they can never learn. Mm. It's always like it's indeed a snapshot. It contains all the way until there, or let's say the path that got them there, but there it stops because I think the conscious mind isn't inhabiting it anymore, so it cannot really learn. So that's why I'm also thinking about these large language models. They only only learn at the speed at which our collective consciousness is learning. So it is gathering all the knowledge that we've gained until now, and it's a great simulacra as a great golem to work through. But to think that it has the spark of consciousness, I don't think so. I see that is probably a leap, but I think that's also, I would go on all tangents, but I think that's coming from the materialist ontology or the framework that we as a collective, or that the collective mostly inhabits still. And then that states that consciousness comes from matter. And so have enough computing power together and then consciousness will arrive. But I'm not operating on that framework. So for me, the whole exercise seems a bit strange. If we treat these machines in a way or in a way which they're not. But yeah, being haunted by your own ghosts. I've been trying to get comfortable with it. One way I think I'm comfortable with it is to try to show up as fully as possible in any situation. So to be very honest, because then I don't look back and then think about my words. Oh, why did I say it like that or this? I don't have talking points prepared. So I don't get to cringe about the way I say things because they come out how they come out.
Yeah. So cool to be chatting with you. I love the frame of simulacra and the golem kind of, or the kind of avatar projections. And it's interesting because I've been trying to do this podcast that seemed like a good idea at the time as a way to kind of free up my time so I can write my next book. But then the podcast, I've done three, like 1 to 1.5 hour episodes that I haven't published because every time I've done it, it just didn't feel right. Like it felt like I was performing or it felt like it was contrived. And then there's this rational part of me is like, oh, come on, you've invested the time. And there's still part of my world is that I need to kind of somehow manifest in, you know, in an appealing way for enterprises, kind of where Robin Hood the funds and buy me the time to kind of do the work I want to do. Trying to use the, I blame the plant medicine. I'm now listening to my body and my intuition and it's making me feel things. And I'm not.
It's super funny because when you say like I Robin Hood, I'm like, you're not escaping the image anymore that you're a rogue or a bard that is disguised or that is disguised as a wizard.
But it's a funny thing, right? Because even in corporate land, you literally have to costume up. You have to kind of put on your suits and there's the theater, there's roles and titles, you're introduced, there's power dynamics and, you know, so a lot of the role in that regard, the wizard thing, lets me slip past the cognitive gatekeepers, and then I can do my jester trickster work, but and then possibly not get booked again. But you know, but yeah, this whole it's been so, gosh, I used to scoff at people that would talk about intuition, because I would say, oh, intuition is just pattern recognition, and you have the and yet now it's one of the most profound guides. And do you ever, and it's just, you know, how long did it take? Did it take you long to shake off the feeling of this, like, what if people think I'm silly? No. Or that stuff, like, that.
I want to say it's somewhere here on the shoulders, so it's still there, but it's probably not that big anymore. So it's not a very heavy worry, but it's something that you have to think, be somewhat aware of, because you also don't want to be too overly serious and too. I can be like that from time to time, but yeah, you want to have the space to. Also play around,
because you manifest beautifully, or your similar, how do you say it, simulacrum, what's the plural,
simulacra,
yeah, your simulacra manifest beautifully on LinkedIn, which is a platform devoid of much you know, warmth and wholesomeness, yet there are wonderful folks that do manifest it. And then I really like how you show up. I like the photos that you share, the sense of place. There's almost, I mean, and of course, this is part of the wily game of myth making, because there's the myth of you that one such as I and others will assemble based upon the breadcrumb trail that you leave of beautiful photos. And now that I know that you have an affinity with birds of prey, I'm just imagining you with, like, you know, an eagle or a hawk coming to your call and perching on your shoulder whilst the storm rages through the forest. And as I said to you in our last time, I certainly would love to, even though I think we should all fly less these days, I would certainly love to think I could make some sort of pilgrimage to your area. It'd be so wonderful to spend time with you in person in the part of the world that you are, because it sounds incredibly special.
Oh, lovely. Nice.
But just going back to the practices of a developing shaman or a shaman on the path to greater depth and eventually the Grove of Elders. Why am I asking this? It's not that I want to map it necessarily, but I do want to sense into, are there any rhythms or rituals, or is there an intentionality in terms of a practice that you have, or is it something that is more guided by intuition and kind of spontaneity, or is there a seasonality to how you go about things?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is also something that has been, that can sometimes bother me, because we can also be quick to chastise ourselves to not perform in a sort of rigor and like, oh, we set certain, this is my daily routine, I don't know, life hacking bullshit. that just doesn't work for me, because I think I've lived most of my life being incredibly rough, let's say, or rigorous in the sense of how I walk about in life and these kind of things, which would result in me just collapsing when I get home, or just collapsing in either gaming or whatever, just to have ways of just shutting off. And I can now perceive that as a maybe neurodivergence and blah blah masking. We could put all these different abstractions or frameworks on, yeah, names on it. What I feel nowadays is I'm using the word shaman because there aren't that many other type of words that fit well or that speak to the collective mind to signal. What are the kind of things I'm interested in or the practices that I'm doing? But I'm also not necessarily claiming the title because I don't know what a shaman is. And I read somewhere that usually the title shaman is not taken but given by the community.
Bestowed.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And at the same time, I also dig wizardry because if I picture shamanism and wizardry, where I see wizardry is the shaping of matter. It's I see wizardry as quite masculine in its channeling. It's channeling mind. It's imposing maps on reality and having reality shift to those maps. Mm-hmm. If you do that well and well-intentioned, you can do great things with that. Where I see shamanism is more, how to say this? Is more a allowing oneself to blend with more than just your own psyche and more than just your body, and to open yourself up to other forms of intelligence, other forms of consciousness, and to be a conduit, to allow those things to move through, to be able to channel, to voice things that don't have a voice, but also to feel things that normally would not be felt. So how does the consciousness of water feels like? Or how, when you're interacting in the forest, you can talk to trees. You can intuitively feel the tree and ask it questions. And then if you're in a right mind state, the thoughts that will come up, if you make yourself a sort of blank canvas and then you just have the background static of the cosmos, let's say, whatever thoughts are bubbling up when you drop a question in the well, you can be sure that the answers are different if you're making contact with a tree or sitting below a tree than if you're doing it by yourself in a sterile room. And
I love that.
So I think that's where the shamanism is the training, I think, to be open and to be really in tune. But the wizardry is the craft of then what do you do with the energies that flow through you? And are you capable of directing them to useful or, let's say, helpful purposes?
Yeah, there's definitely a I'd say that, but to the same extent that the one of the limitations of the path of wizardry is that the perils of abstraction of kind of abstracting things like I want to kind of go quite geeky with a lot of like different namings of things. So it's fun because we look at different schools of magic: divination, necromancy, abjuration, conjuration, invocation, and divination, and so forth. But coming back to this thing that you were saying about the attunement and the acuity and the sensing into other intelligences, and particularly when working with plant medicine. What I find, there's two parts to the question that I want to ask here. First is, I find it so bizarre when people are experimenting with plant medicine in such sterile contexts where people are having psilocybin or something, but then it's people in white lab coats with clipboards and stuff like that. That doesn't feel like the... I mean, it just means that the plant's going to have to do a lot more heavy lifting, but it doesn't. So I'd love to hear a sense from you, and I'd be curious too, and also curious on behalf of other friends that I have, when you're working online with someone and they're, sorry, I'm giving you a question, Cloud. You can take whatever you want roll with it.
No,
you're working online with someone who are, they've been able to source access to some plant medicine, they're not necessarily that experienced or used to doing it before. How do you go about setting or I don't know, because, you know, if the vibes aren't quite right or if energetically it doesn't feel like the right, like how do you as from a shaman lens tend to the context? If that's even a question.
That's a very good question. So I haven't... I haven't had experiences with clients abroad yet that want to do psychedelics that haven't done it before. I would So I would have to sense in really with the person, like, where are they at? How does it feel to them? Is it what is their intention? How are they stepping into it? Is there already a lot of anxiety, or is there? Does it feel like a grasping or a reaching? Like, oh, I need something to help
like a
me.
Desperation.
Yeah, desperation. Mm. So I think it would highly depend on the person, the situation, also the country that they're in. I've journeyed, or I'm now way more comfortable with traveling on by myself with different compounds, knowing that I've had plenty of experiences which are sort of a challenging, borderline bad trip. I think by now you would call bad trip something that leaves a lasting mark, sort of an event that traumatizes. I don't think I've had those. I did have, well, very, very challenging experiences, but mostly when you surface from those, it also builds up this resilience that you sense like, okay, even if things get really, really heavy, you're still there with a sort of center. To set and setting plays a, my experience by now is it plays a very, very big role in where you're traveling to. So if we are novices, and I don't think they're experts when it comes to plant medicine. That's, again, they're trying to fence something that's super wild. I think they're experienced people, and there are massive gradations in that. So I would say I'm beyond novice. I'm experienced. But I know for sure that there are people who are way more experienced and are capable of navigating way different realms. So that being said, my experience with set and setting has been has become more and more a means of a sort of almost setting a course to somewhere. So that you say like, okay, I'm fed up with this pattern, or this something that I'm constantly running into, or it feels like it's right about time to journey again. Often I can sort of feel it coming up. And then usually I have a sense of where is it going to go. And then you try to at least set your direction in such a way. You will still be massively surprised and will get sucker punched, let's say, because it's also the hubris of the mind to say, like, I know where we're going. And you also don't want to end up in a position where you're fighting with whatever plant medicine or plant spirit, how pronounced it is, that you're fighting with it, like, no, I don't want to go here, and if you're being placed there. So there's also a lot of
as in fighting or resisting. I know that they're related, but like,
yeah, I'd say resisting, that you're like, no, you're okay. I've had it also with experiencing different plant medicines, you also become a bit more familiar with the sort of intelligence that's tied to it. So for instance, mushrooms, we have different types of mushrooms, so they'll be different. You also have truffles, for instance. Those feel very chaotic. They are intelligent, but when you journey, often I feel the body load is very high, and it feels very. You feel all the fluids in the body. It feels like you're turning into a swamp of sorts, and in that sense, and I get very strange imagery often with truffles. LSD, for instance, that feels like it's a synthesized compound. It is coming, it's tied to a fungus, or at least it was originally extracted from a fungus. There it's a completely different intelligence and completely different experience, and LSD feels way more wizardry like for me, because there's less of an other intelligence that is communicating with you. It feels way more like you're just your field, or your sense of being is placed into a different mode. But yeah, I've had experiences with ayahuasca where if you're struggling with trying to give in. So the ego, even if it's subconsciously the ego is fighting, is resisting, yeah, then you have a very, very shitty trip.
This is the second part of the question I wanted to ask. And I saw this meme, and actually I'm feeling a little bit hesitant, maybe. Like there's a daringness, but there was a meme that I shared related to, found that it is related to ayahuasca. And it's not really nicely worded. But I wanted to ask you, and so let me just, I'll read it out to you. And I hope that I don't know if there's any, I hope that we feel appropriately worded, that we're not going to invoke anything. And like, this is done with respect and inquiry. Ayahuasca is insane because it appears to be one of the most legitimately dangerous drugs with the potential to gigafry your brain, but is exclusively taken by literal turbo normies who unironically want to heal internalized racism trauma and basically get one-shotted by it. Literally the most spiritually inept people in existence having their little brains rearranged by some Mesoamerican six-dimensional demon who makes them quit their email job, divorce their boyfriend or girlfriend, and become a traveling circus stripper or whatever. So, I mean, there's a bit of like vitriol here, but I've, as someone who hasn't done ayahuasca, when I hear of people doing it, I'm like, well, here's my sense of it. It's like, if you're not doing it, or even in South America, like the context has changed, as I think we alluded to it, but like, it is something that you want to do in right relation, right?
that's the thing. So I haven't done ayahuasca ceremonies in a while. I did a couple in 1 year, and I did them all in a Dutch setting, different settings, group ceremonial setting with nightly singing and like a lot of ritual around it. Relatively low dose. I've also done a higher dose with more like the more Western secularized way, that like with eye covers, you lay down and you drink and you have a bucket to vomit. But that was higher dose. And yes, so if we tie back to the meme, that was, I think, a main catalyst for me to become aware, like, okay, ayahuasca, magic mushrooms, yes, that grows here in the West. You can find it outdoors, or you can grow it on your own. Ayahuasca is a whole different thing, and in the level of intensity. And I already had a lot of our previous experiences with different psychoactive substances. So I think my sensitivity in general is quite high. So when I took that, I went on, I think, such a deep journey, which really shook the way I saw reality, because I saw, yeah, of course, I will not go into like long trip, blah, blah stories, but really fundamental, it really made me question like fundamental aspects of reality. And I think the main experience I had, and this was in a secular setting, so we weren't outdoors, there was no shaman in that sense with the practitioners were doing energetic clearing, and they were good, very good sitters and therapists. But here comes the but. I sort of could perceive the sort of field that was being opened and how transpersonal that is, and that the demons or the things that people are going through moves through the rooms. So you could perceive that. You can see the energy move from one person into another. And then it's like I started to get worried, like, okay, what if I'm throwing my weight around to people who, let's say, turbo normies, was that the quote? ayahuasca goes incredibly deep, and the spirit, sort of spiritual landscape, and the spirits that are tied to it are, in my best estimate, very much real.
That's lovely, though, that your emergent concern was you don't want to impact others, whereas other folks would be like, oh, I hope their shit doesn't impact me. You know, it's that's quite benevolent and lovely. Or so it's like, not even lovely for me. That's quite you know, it's almost like the quality of lucid dreaming, but the ability, as in the Buddhist practice of lucid dreaming, where you want to show up and actually be benevolent and minimize suffering in dreams, even to actually be on in the depths of the trip itself, and to have the consciousness that, oh, I don't want to negatively impact the experience of others. That's pretty profound.
Yeah, but that sort of. That was before I started doing sort of more real, like rigorous, sort of pursuing shamanic training, because I became so, beforehand, I did things with solo journeying with psychedelics, also with clients with low doses. I was like, I feel confident in navigating that space. But I, for some reason, I was very hesitant, and I'm feeling less and less that hesitancy to do deep journeying with people, because I've been aware of how deep those go, and often it plays a role that the you create a shared field, a shared field of consciousness. You can use different words, and you'll sort of how experienced the group is how deep you can go. But if I'm sitting with someone else and where I'm making this up as I go, because I don't know the actual measured rules for this, but this is how it feels to me. It's like, if my field is capable and is willing to go very, very deep, and I'm working with a turbo normie, if someone isn't that open to go that deep, it's very important for me to stick with them. But if I overstep my bounds, maybe I pull people down into places where they might not be ready for. And I felt that. I had that sense like, okay, I want to be way more in tune and way more rigorous with the forces that we interact with when we open these kind of spaces, and have more practices of how to do that, and how to energetically interact with these things, and how to clear rooms, and how to help people through it. And that goes, I think, the secular framework I needed to chuck out the window for that.
Yeah, makes sense. There's part of me that is currently fascinated on many levels by entities. At one level, I don't know why. I'm sorry. At a very basic level, there's part of me that's still fascinated by the fact that the word identity is like the entity of the id. But it's not necessarily like that, but identity, like, just it's there. But then I was interested in egregores, particularly in enterprise land, how you have companies that almost have their own manifestations, and people sacrifice their time and efforts and so on to get, you know, to serve these egregores, algorithms as egregores and so on. But then there's another thing which comes back to this fear of being silly, or of like losing the thread. Like, I need to kind of like have one hand kind of just still in consensus reality, but multidimensional entities is just I'm in the point where I acknowledge that, of course, there are higher dimensions, and of course we have a limited perspective of things, and of course one of the conduits may be plant medicines and other things like that. And so it's an open field, but it's also one that I intuitively sense that must tread carefully in. And again, we come back to the hubris of naming. I mean, I think I saw there's a list of like 153 names of various daemons or things like that with their corresponding symbols and so forth. And that reminds me of like wizards who have the hubris of drawing some sort of summoning circle and thinking that they can contain an entity just because they've kind of wrote the right sequence of sigils and so forth, which again strikes me as that patriarchal kind of trying to box or domesticate what is inherently wild, as opposed to how a shaman might approach it, which seems much more relational. And yeah, it's I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's an open.
This is a great thread, because one of the main interests I've had becoming sort of meta crisis involved or meta crisis aware was and still is this layer of reality where we have egregores, like these socially distributed intelligences, or you could call them demons in other terms, or daemons or entities indeed.
Self-organizing
and how they move as sort of I think socially distributed intelligence makes sense to me, that it's like almost like a cloud computer that sits in different nodes of humans, and there's a web and exists in the between space. And I've been so fascinated with this, because ever since I saw these collective coordination problems. So the whole world is going to shit, but no one has the coordination to do anything about it. And then I'm not making hyperbole. I really feel like it's going like that. Then I was thinking like, okay, yeah, of course, probably people listening to this are familiar with the concept of Moloch as being one of these kind of entities. And these are then... I think it's important when you're interacting with entities, or when you're attempting to interact with entities, to have a sense, where are they coming from and how are they related to me? So how much Moloch do I carry within myself? What are the shadow parts where these demons, let's say, breed? One, I had a call with someone. He used the sentence which I really loved. He said, demons, they grow in corners. Because in corners, there's still air. There's no movement there, and there that's where sort of like the same with fungus in the fungus in your in the bathroom. So you can also see the collective intelligence of a forest is also an entity of sorts. The Gaia, I think, is a consciousness, is an entity. Stars have a consciousness. So I think stars are very much connected to angels in a sense, because if you look recently, there were these extremely high definition images of the sun and then putting things into scale. And I was just so in awe. Then you have the solar flares and then the planet, our planet, put next to it. And it's like, I can tell why Homo sapiens used to worship the sun, and I found it a bit odd that we don't anymore, because we are in the body of the sun, let's say. It's the emanating strength of it. I'm going a bit on a tangent, but the thing I want to go for is entities which are human bred. I think what we would classically call demons, like Moloch, I think Moloch had a seed already early in the life of the biosphere. Maybe this high competition short-termism is already present in bacteria, this kind of seed of being.
Yeah.
But it took, let's say, our collective Homo sapiens as a superorganism to really spawn it. And to then it becomes personified, or it becomes, I think, an entity of sorts. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, if you're talking about like a demonology list of like, here's a list of them with their names. Of course, naming things also makes them more solid. It solidifies them. And that's the thing, the recursive act with an egregore is like, if you focus your attention long enough on something, it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
And so when it comes down to interacting with entities also in the psychedelic space or in dream space, or I think it's caution is much advised. It's not like, yeah, let's listen to everything that this snake with two heads is saying to me. Mm-hmm. That, of course mm-hmm. not. But to feel into and try to discern what is the taste of this thing? Where is it coming mm-hmm. from? What mm-hmm. What does this feel like? What spawned this? I've more trust in things that grew organically from the Amazon. And then I mean literally like the literal physical stuff, but also these spirits that might have arisen from this massive wood. And we probably have similar type of entities in the West. It's just that we paved it over with industrialism mm-hmm. and we cut down all the old growth trees.
Mm-hmm.
So they're probably still there, but we have to find mm-hmm. ways of communicating with that. But there's a big difference, I think, in communicating with these kind of things than communicating with a techno demon molo kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is fascinating. I'm glad I'm not the only one. Look at life as substrate for greater collective intelligences or entities. And then think about Moloch and maybe the early seed with bacteria and the rivalrous dynamics there. But really coming back to money being an abstraction. So like money not actually being a resource itself, but a meta optionality token that could be a claim on energy on literally anything else on the planet. So it's an extreme abstraction. Coupled that with exponential tech, where suddenly we're having to navigate global coordination issues, which were previously just locally bound. So previously, if demons live in corners, and because corners are where like there's not as much movement, and part of the role of trickster is inviting like microdosing chaos. If we're in right relationship with trickster, we're like we're bringing in subtle disruptions, and we're dancing, and we're keeping that alive. But if we don't do that, if we keep things sterile and domesticated and contained and boxed in, that kind of latent chaos energy builds up and it leaks and it comes in to kind of destabilize things and often to much more dramatic effect. And so, you know, I'm still kind of the naive belief that there's no such thing as bad entities. Well, not bad, there's no such thing as evil or bad entities. But that does not to say that there aren't entities that intend harm. It's just that we need to, with caution and perhaps with some wiliness and some, you know, appropriate empathy or something, like there's a way to move. There's a kind of perambulating or kind of an obliquity, like surreptitious kind of circumventing, if that makes sense.
You don't want to confront it head on. Mm. So if we indeed have a, I've been also interested in that. So what is the history of trying to revolt against empire, against the egregore of empire, of control, of the system, of Moloch, of blah, blah, the Matrix. And then like, I had a stint of reading like the Deleuze and a bit like all this kind of theory, which I enjoyed. And like, okay, how do you escape this sort of...
I just had this terrible thought of Andrew Tate, you know, how he thinks that he's escaped the Matrix, that kind of toxic masculinity kickboxing guy.
Yeah, I've escaped it by fully embodying it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but... as you were talking about, there was quite a bit of feedback happening. If we don't tend to the corners, and we haven't, I think the... okay, I'm going to see where this one goes. If the enlightenment, we use the word, it's enlightenment. Oh, great light is being shined and it's illuminating the room. It illuminates everything except our own shadow. So the people who are so wise standing in, oh, I'm standing basking in the light of science and all this thing. And I see these massive shadows being cast in the back, into the corners. So I think we're currently living in a time where we as a collective are least aware in recent history of the metaphysical or of the spirit realm, if I just want to use that term. We're least aware of it, that it's actually a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the most heavy overshoot of human-produced spirits in the spirit realm currently, which are convincing us, in a sense, this is what I think, that there's also this convincing happening on a subtle level. It's often difficult to imply intentionality with these kind of things, but I'm using it for the sake of this metaphor in this frame. There's this active move that is happening that wants to keep the subjects unaware of this layer of reality, because that's where they grow. We are the substrate on which these entities grow. And if we're not aware of that massive shadow that we're casting, that's where they're growing. So they want to keep our heads like, no, just keep it like that. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see that. But at the same time, we have this, almost sort of this nation-spanning, supranational, planet-wide network of finance, for instance, like a metabolism of this superorganism, which is digesting the planet. And what is it using the metabolites for? Well, it's creating this AI, for instance. So what is the telos here? Where is this thing going? And so I'm so curious about what are we being ridden by, and how do we turn around our relationship to this? So how do we do that?
Yeah. How do we, whatever it is, stop the superorganism from eating its host or consuming its host? There's a few things that emerged there. It just occurred to me, often when you're preparing a space, set and setting with like a sage, smudge stick and so on, you're often paying attention to the corners in rooms, which is interesting. And it just occurred to me. And the other thing too is that particularly the Western society and particularly modernity does so love its light and its illumination, whereas perhaps there is this practice. I've been really warm to the word glimmers, which are, to my mind, you have to be amidst the dark for long enough for your eyes to adjust, for you to then be able to perceive and discern that which you'd have no possibility of seeing if it was kind of brightly lit as we do. And we have so much artificial, we've lit things up so artificially that we've blinded ourselves to the deeper things that are at play. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, have you read the book There Is No Anti-Mimetics Division?
Nope. Sounds cool.
Oh. Yes, I think you'll like that. So there is little short science fiction book by Quantum exploring the notion of anti-memes, which are kind of like memes, but you can't, like, so often the joke is, and if you had read the book, that would be an incredible joke, because the people that you know have read the book, you can say, did you enjoy the book? And they're like, what book? Because it's very much entities that kind of consume the knowledge that you have of an experience of them. And so there's this anti-mimetics division that is trained to pursue these entities. But of course there is no anti-mimetics division because, like, oh yeah, anyway.
Nice. I'm feeling that.
Yeah, what we're kind of grasping and gesturing towards in this kind of really, at least I'm speaking for myself here on behalf of Western society, this deeply adolescent, immature, bereft of what could have been, like in Australia, with our genociding of the majority of the indigenous population, there were song lines that have lasted for 60 plus thousand years that we just don't have anymore. Oh, and yeah, so then the opportunity then for to be taken for a ride. And then here's the other thing that flares up with me. This kind of vigilant thing is like, uh-oh, I'm going to have some folks listen to this thinking I'm like been imbibing too much Joe Rogan and all the other things, you know, and yeah.
That's indeed, that has been a, also a line that I want to tread gently. Okay, I'm just going to use it as an example. Alex Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So Alex Jones as a figure is like a, how I would describe him is like a chaos sorcerer who has been fully dipped into his own summonings and is just like fully a full blast ridden by whatever he is focusing on. That doesn't mean, here we go, that doesn't mean that he's incorrect about everything. Obviously, he's a rambling madman in a lot of things, but he might be also perceiving. And then I don't want to focus on Alex Jones. I don't listen to his show. I don't find that quality of inquiry interesting. It's amusing when you see a YouTube clip of the guy going fully rant insane. You laugh about it, but at the same time, if you're looking at a certain thing and you're picking up a signal, it then depends on how well are your map-making skills to discern what the signal is and not jump to conclusions too far, to collapse it too quickly into, oh, it's this. Oh, it's definitely pedophilic psychic vampires or something. It's like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's wait with calling it what it is, but let's perceive. Let's perceive and follow a signal that's there. It's the same with the unidentified aerial phenomena. They used to call it UFOs. UFOs. Mm-hmm. I had to figure out what is the new term. 5 years back, I would have been like, yeah, whatever. It's all hoax bullshit. Is it, though? And can we also keep it open that we don't know? But it's super childish and also dangerous to prematurely say no, it doesn't exist. Oh no, exactly. No, that's bullshit.
And I think that's the kind of trap that we've been in with modernity, which has an absolute intolerance for mystery. Yeah. And to the point that folks, and I used to be in this camp, the folks that are on the kind of the fringe, on the periphery, that aren't part of the kind of the herd, the kind of the center of the consensus reality, they're often further ostracized or kind of belittled or, you know, reduced as crackpot, whatever, tinfoil hat and so on, and dismissed. But yeah, the kind of, while still having some wise discernment, not simply just discernment where we're kind of trying to categorize things and judge whether there's this and that, but just wise discernment of kind of sensing into it, we might be able to open ourselves up to a bit more mystery. And that's a profound gateway to a deeper gnosis. And we're not very good at it, though,
no,
as a society.
We might start peering at corners a little bit. And it's like, what happens if you peek from the corner of your eye? What are you seeing over there?
And, you know, there's this thing that the most common thread when I try to gently have these conversations is almost everyone, not everyone, but almost everyone is very aware of vibes. So, you know, they'll know if they walk into a room and the energy's off or something, or the vibes kind of things like that. And that's an interesting lens for folks to start to appreciate the deeper energetics of these. I mean, it's a baby step towards the, you know, the super intelligent entities that we're talking about. But yeah, there's something in that. And there's this, I don't know. I'm not sure how to, I think it comes back to the nature of the internet too. So people could be having these experiences, and in the context of a conversation amongst friends or amongst teachers or fellow practitioners, that's great sense-making landscape and so on. But when it's kind of platformed on YouTube where you're interviewed as an expert and so on, and then you then start believing your own well, it sets up those recursive loops where you, so there seems to be perils all about the place.
Yeah, many, many. No. No, these are excellent points.
I should have checked with you. How are you going for time? I know that we're an hour and 20 minutes in.
Oh, I'm still definitely good for another 10, 15
okay,
minutes.
Okay, great. Maybe we'll That's start. I haven't seen you have a sip of water this whole time.
No, I drank a mug of tea when we started.
Oh, okay.
If I drink too much, then we're in a bar, of course. So how many drinks in are the, right.
What would you? What, the shaman? I'm in a funny space with alcohol these days.
Funny how you put that in quotation marks. Alcohol. Is it something else?
I honestly don't know why I did that. But I'm finding myself. I used to love whiskeys, but now it just takes. It's the second drink, and then my sleep is ruined. Maybe I'm just getting older or something like that. But so I have this hesitancy around alcohol these days.
I stopped drinking around. Sort of when I had my burnout and sort of the existential depression, because I kept noticing that my pattern of drinking was one of numbing, and I noticed that that wasn't working anymore. So when I started drinking, I became more depressed. So I was like, okay, then I'm not going to do it anymore. But ever since I also noticed that I started a meditative practice in that year. I don't have that kind of rigorous practice anymore, like a sort of tempting and vipassana. But I noticed that if I had only one drink the night before, my focus was super scattered. It was so much more difficult to be in this sort of calm setting. And then I noticed, like, okay, so even if I microdose alcohol, it will have a an effect on me, which I'm not pursuing. It has an effect of sort of numbing, while I was also at this time microdosing with psychoactive substances like psilocybin or with kapi, which is a active compound in ayahuasca. And I noticed that, with these things, I feel more. So I'm confronted more by whatever is going on in here, but it helps me to be more fully alive. And then I could sense, like, okay, alcohol is mainly giving me like a holiday from myself, but it always comes with a price. And I was like, okay, I'm done taking holidays from this thing.
Yeah.
And I just want to journey into this thing.
Yeah, nice. That's beautiful. Because I was going to ask, what would this shaman and wizard have at the bar if not alcohol? I don't know. Nice cup of tea.
Nice
cannabis pipe or something.
I'd say cannabis would probably be a good fit. Maybe a blue lotus has been
I actually saw a thing that you put out recently on LinkedIn. Has anyone had any experience with it? And I actually asked some friends of mine, and they don't know that they didn't have. I didn't have anything much to report back other than that. I didn't want to open up the Blackstone tablet to see, because that's a trap. I don't really know much about it. Blue Lotus. Apparently, it grows around here too, in Dells, in Victoria as well.
Oh, really? Yeah, apparently. I said this to someone. I pursued a career in molecular biology. So I spent, I would say, 6 years of my life quite a bit in a laboratory doing genetics.
This is a doctor, Simon van der Els, here.
Yes.
Yes.
I have, since my burnout, or since I was, I mostly burnt out on writing the thesis, because the language just doesn't gel well with how my brain works. And so it was, and together with a lot of other shit happening at the moment. But I was like, okay, but if I take my soul's path serious, as in nothing happens really coincidentally, like these big, like 6 years working in a lab is not a coincidence. I'm like doing very intricate work. I'm like, how am I going to reintegrate this part of me? I like cooking. I like making nice food. I enjoy doing that. But I'm like, am I going to pursue like a more traditional medicine style shamanism? And I'm like, maybe. So I'm keeping that door open because otherwise I have no clue why I've been doing very, very specialized laboratory work. So tinctures, seeing how to work with plant medicines, combining them. I've had great experiences combining different plant medicines. And Blue Lotus. Blue Lotus is fascinating. I've been, this year is the only year, I started this year with imbibing more or trying to use it in correct settings. And I'm still figuring out like what is the sort of, what works well. And also to be respectful with what intelligence is tied to it. I've had a beautiful experience combining Blue Lotus with cannabis that goes very, very well together. And you can, there was a moment where I also work with constellations, do systemic work. I did that before I was doing the shamanic training. So I was already enjoying doing that with clients just live out in the woods. Inviting the spirit of a certain plant into a space. If you're doing that with the right set and setting, right intentionality, it works. And you step into that space and you can start communicating with that, especially if you imbibe it. So if the molecules, if you're physically communing with the sort of radio tuning to whatever field that entity is, that egregore or that consciousness, it becomes easier once you, of course, imbibe. But if you become more and more practiced, then you probably can also tune in with, let's say, having to take less. And that's, I think, what happens generally to shamans or practitioners is that they don't need the medicine.
That's similar experience to the friends that I've had, as much smaller and smaller doses because they become much more attuned, which is wonderful. And I have a friend who is quite experienced with a lot of those things. He was just, at one stage he was saying that he's actually just really enjoying certain just breathing in particular ways to enter particular states, and just via the breath alone, which I'm a long way away from, but it's great to know that this is available.
What comes up for me, what I wanted to share is, so we're living in a, this is really a point for me. So we're living in a culture where we're taking a lot of plant medicines, but which are industrially grown. So we're eating a lot of chocolate. We're, some of us are smoking tobacco, coffee. Coffee. A lot of people are taking coffee.
Oh, yeah.
And there is how I think it works with, for instance, these kind of entities, the spirit of a certain plant. Once it's industrialized, the spirit gets diluted because the spirit is tied to all these physical manifestations on the planet. But because of industrial growth, it will be spread out more. So if you smoke a cigarette, which is just produced by the tobacco industry, it's a completely different experience than if you smoke, for instance, mapacho or certain types of tobacco, which come from the jungle or are dried there. And to get that inkling or how much that difference really, or how much that difference expresses itself and how big that difference is, has also a huge effect on our daily consciousness. So if your daily consciousness is macro-dosing coffee and maybe macro-dosing different types of alcohols and these kind of things, perhaps see what happens if you micro-dose or macro-dose other types of plant medicines. Like Blue Lotus, for instance, take it in the tea. Sense how your day is when you do that. There can be such an intentional relationship to these kind of things. And by doing it more intentionally, but also imbibing in different types of plant entities in that sense, there's such a big support that can come from that, such a relief. And this goes past like all supplements, blah, blah, shit, mass produced. I'm thinking more of there's so much value when it's in the, also in the matrix of when all the compounds are in the in the whole matrix of the thing. So you're eating or you're eating extractions from a plant, but it's not a single compound. And I think there's a lot of the chance that it's a more holistic ecosystemic relationship that you're undergoing with the compound is much higher when you're taking the full thing.
Yeah, this is amazing. I have a friend that has some contact to folks, and I don't know if you ever heard of the meme of Byron Bay. It's a place in Australia that a lot of it's our main kind of place for experimental and plant medicine and all that. But I saw this friend was talking about a tincture, and I love the word tincture specifically. And I was looking at that. The price was quite high for this, and it had all this copy about how it was harvested and how it was the full thing and how it was combined with this, which is like complementary. But now I'm beginning to realize that perhaps actually there's a lot of intentionality going into the actual formulations of this, and the price warrants the care and the actual cultivation and the intentionality around single points of origin and the whole thing that have gone into that. So I'm going to look at that again with a new set of, like a fresh set of eyes, because I agree with you that the magic doesn't scale. Like as soon as you intervene in some sort of extractive abstractive like process, it
excellent. I think the only magic that scales is probably illusion magic.
True. Yeah, that's right. that's true. We should probably begin to wrap up. I'm just curious, just kind of for like maybe just the second time in this whole conversation, remembering that this may be listened to by folks. Justin, do you have anything that you want to share with the unknown listeners that will be listening to the simulacra that we've just conjured together whilst we go on and live our lives, unless these phantom forms persist in the internet? Is there anything that you might want to just suggest or leave with them?
And that's a nice invitation. I'm gonna see, and I'm gonna take a moment to see what comes up.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be quite a different experience, the insight for a lot of folks that listen to my work. We've mostly seen me in my corporate persona form, or like my enterprise, costume and disposition. But I'm excited to kind of open the window to these things, because there might be some folks that have kind of heard some of these things, and if they've actually been the type that would listen an hour and 30 minutes into this conversation, then I think they're in the right place. So there are no coincidences.
The main thing that's coming up is that there's this big burp that wants to happen.
Interesting. So, if we come full circle, you were talking about the vomiting at the start, and now you just like...
Yeah. I think it's really about I think what I would want to share them with the listeners, and it probably goes, I try to go past cliche. It's not focus on the breath, but really focus on the intestines, just to focus on your GI tract. Focus on whatever bubbling is happening in the stomach, is happening in the small intestine, the large intestine, and feel into the sort of uncomfort that might be there, because there are corners in our intestine, like congestion, indigestion. Tune into that. What has been, what have you been, what has been fermenting inside of you that probably wants to go out, that probably needs to go out, and to sense into your body, what is that? And that probably, if you're taking a moment, feel into the stomach or feel into the intestine, travel where does it feel a bit tight, where does it feel bubbly, sense what kind of emotions come up, what kind of images come up, what kind of words, what kind of experiences, memories. And that will tie you like, okay, this is tied to something that I'm holding on to and that is fermenting in my brain. And it's also, it's causing all kind of mayhem. It's causing bad gas, alcohols, etc. That's what's coming up.
Yeah, that's wonderful, even profound for me. What's my... Kim is away at the moment, and I've been noticing that I've been eating a bit more bread than normal, and just like, but just even just tuning into that as even a deeper metaphor for what is fermenting, and that. Oh, sorry, I feel like I've just there's a beautiful space that you're there, and then I kind of just trod on it, my own kind of processing of it, but
not at all.
That's I like that it is beyond cliche, because it's also not a region that I personally intentionally tune into. And even as I do that, I've got to realize I'm kind of sucking in my belly, and just like there's a self-consciousness, and like, oh, it's like, yeah, this is not just not what a wizard does, you know. Wizard stays up here, doesn't go down. Oh, this is good for my listeners, our listeners too. So Simon, thank you. This is like only the second time that we've spoken, and I feel a deep kinship and affinity with you, and I feel very grateful that somehow we've found each other across the planet, and I look forward to more conversations ahead.
This is great, Jason. I'm having so much fun, and yeah, there are plenty of bars to walk into, so let's continue that journey.
Wonderful. Thank you. And that was Simon and I in conversation. I hope you enjoyed that. Yeah, I'd like to say that this is, as we described, this is like, this is a simulacra that we've created. The real us will be going on and living on through this, but this conversation itself is something I'm increasingly realizing is a living conversation that doesn't necessarily happen in the open arena of the algorithmic web, where the hot topics of the month and the year that are usually aligned to Moloch and the whims of capitalism, hence why you see most podcasts and books these days are orientated around productivity, or anything else that's aligned to the prevailing paradigm ideology of capitalism, which is perpetuating the self-terminating path that we are on in society, and is essentially consuming the very host that life depends upon. Yes, if you go outside of the open arena, these are living conversations that happen. It's in the underground. It happens via your venturing into obscure podcasts, but you start to kind of sense, and there's this, other people have mapped this, the liminal web, the kind of emergent web, the various practitioners. My dear friend Joe Lightfoot will hopefully someday soon be releasing his wonderful paper or essay that articulates this or gestures this kind of map of the liminal web, the emergent, I don't even know quite how to say it, but there's a there. There is something alive that is emerging here, that is a viable alternative option to the default way that we are doing things. And it's just, it's wonderful to be alive and questing amidst this. So thank you so much for being the type of person to listen to such an episode all the way through. And you know, I'll still be doing a dance. I need to kind of sometimes do antics within the Overton window. It's partly how I apply my craft, and that then buys me time to then do the questing outside of the Overton window. So, yeah, I look forward to more of that, and thank you once again for joining me, and happy solstice times, and we'll see you in the new year.